Welcome to the Mayo Clinic Cardiovascular Continuing Medical Education Podcast. Join us each week to discuss the most pressing topics in cardiology and gain valuable insights that can be directly applied to your practice.
Hello, welcome to Interview with the Experts. I'm Dr. Patricia Pelica, cardiologist at Mayo Clinic. I'm joined here with a couple experts to talk about the topic of lifetime strategy in the management of aortic stenosis. Our experts today are Dr. Makram Alid, Professor of Medicine, Interventional Cardiologist, and Dr. Kevin Greeson, Associate Professor of Surgery from our Department of Cardiovascular Surgery. Both are authorities in the subject of the management of aortic stenosis. This area has certainly changed a lot in the past 10 to 20 years. I remember when Dr. Brunwald wrote his editorial 30 years ago saying that the most common cause of death in patients with severe aortic stenosis was surgery. That is certainly not the case. Kevin, what do you think of that?
Right. Oh, I don't even know where to begin. I think we've improved a lot over the last 30 years, you know. So now our mortality is down around 1%, you know, and I think the benefits of the quality of life improvement make it a low risk procedure with high benefit.
Thank you. Mac, how has the treatment changed in your interventional world?
Well, I completely agree, Patty. It's with Kevin also that, you know, it's now that we can tailor the treatment to the patient's preferences and also their longevity and risk for surgery, I think we have a lot more options. So that's resulted in a lower mortality for these patients.
What's the relative use of TAVR versus surgical approaches for patients that we're seeing now?
It's about 50-50 at this point. Kevin might have more specifics there, but we've seen a steady trend that the rates of TAVR are increasing and surgery has been pretty consistent for AVR. Kevin, do you agree?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is that older, sicker people are getting TAVI now, whereas before they weren't getting anything. So I think that is responsible for the large increase in our volume. And there's always like a set group of patients that are probably going to be best served with surgery. And I don't think that group has really changed. Although I do see that in the future that TAVI will probably have a larger impact for that set of patients moving forward.
With multiple choices now, sometimes the decisions may be challenging. But what would you say are some of the challenging decisions that you have to make when deciding about treatment?
Well, from my perspective, you know, it's a patient-centric focus, and you just lay it out there for them. From a surgical standpoint, one thing I think I like to emphasize is valve durability. Obviously, a mechanical valve is a great option, in my opinion. And people who get mechanical valves when they're 50 and they age on to 80, you know, still have a mechanical valve. So you can do well with that. And I like to highlight that associated comorbidities can be dealt with effectively at surgery. And I think one of the most important ones is atrial fibrillation. You know, we can do a left atrial appendectomy at the time of an aortic valve replacement. And I think that has a significant impact on the patient's life moving forward as far as stroke reduction. And I think that has to be entered into the discussion anytime we're talking about aortic valve replacement in these patients.
Thank you. Mac, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we face younger patients that strongly prefer a tissue valve as well. So we have a lot of in-depth discussions with these patients about mechanical versus tissue prosthesis and try to really get at what the patient's long-term plan is for their aortic valve disease in terms of needing the next valve. And we try to plan that up front, particularly in the patients who were going with a tissue valve, which really is the majority of the patients with aortic stenosis, although the mechanical valve is a big important part of that conversation.
I would say that in our surgical practice, probably 50% of patients end up getting a mechanical valve. And that is kind of an anomaly nationwide. Because if you look at other places, you know, 95% of patients get a biological valve. I think it's just important to have that good conversation with the patients about, you know, what are the risks and benefits of both of those. You know, we're just learning about valve and valve now, really, especially with valve and TAVI. You know, we're putting in a lot of TAVIs thinking we're going to do valve and valve down the road, but we're not quite sure, you know, how that's going to turn out. You know, is that a good lifetime choice? I don't know the answer to that right now.
It certainly leaves the patient with an increasingly, progressively smaller valve area, doesn't it? Even if it's functioning properly.
Right.
Absolutely.
The old Russian doll and doll or whatever they call that, you know.
Tell us a little bit about the concept of commissural alignment. How important is that?
Yeah, it's becoming increasingly important. There's a lot of focus on it in terms of the importance of having the commissures, which are the what support the leaflets. Kind of, they're kind of in between each cusp of the prosthetic valve, and making sure that that's not directly obstructing or in front of the coronary ostium, and that really will allow coronary reaccess more easily, because with these transcatheter valves, we have a stent frame or a cage that's also there, and we also have the native leaflet tissue as well. So when the commissure is also obstructing the coronary as well, that can make it hard for coronary reaccess, and also has other implications. I don't know, Kevin, do you have other things to add to that?
Yeah, I think in my mind, where that's probably going to be a huge thing is for when we plan valve and valve down the road. And I think, you know, if there's a strut right in front of a coronary artery, that is a different set of issues than if there's valve tissue there. I think we're too early in that paradigm to really kind of figure out how important it's going to be and how it impacts what we do down the road. But certainly I agree, you know, access to the coronary arteries is important, especially if we're doing TAVI in younger patients, and we should plan for that.
What is your thoughts about bicuspid valves that become stenotic? Now, there was initial reluctance to do TAVR in those patients. They're now being done, right?
We've done several hundred. The thing about the bicuspid valves is they tend to be more heavily calcified, which can make the procedure a little more difficult, and there's probably a little bit higher risk of stroke. And we tend to do surgery for bicuspid valves on younger patients. So those are several important things that you need to have a good conversation with the patient about before pushing ahead with a TAVI.
The patient conversation is always important, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think our outcomes as far as gradients and paravalvular leak are similar with bicuspid valve, and maybe even a little bit better than the tricuspid valve. Mac, what do you think about that?
I agree. I mean, we've had a good experience with it, and we've learned our approach to sizing the transcatheter valve with these patients, once we have made that decision to do TAVR, is a little bit different. We will size, you know, taking into account the degree of calcification as well. I think in general, we like less oversizing when we have the really high calcium score and the asymmetric bicuspid valves.
Initially, we were concerned about potential longevity of the TAVR valves, and that was one of the arguments for placing them in patients that were elderly and restricting it to the elderly high-risk patients. But now we're getting some long-term data on their longevity, which seems to be pretty good. What would you say the longevity of the TAVR valves is, and what do we do if they fail?
Well, I think that the longevity thus far seems to be similar to bioprosthetic surgical valves from the data we've seen, the 5+ year data that we've seen with the currently available valves. And, you know, the question of what to do when they fail, I think, as Kevin brought up, we're still learning about how often valve in valve is possible. But we can predict that based on the CT and looking at the coronary height, the size of the sinuses, and also the type of valve that we're putting in, how likely it would be that we could put a valve inside of the valve. You know, my prediction is that probably a large proportion of the patients are going to be a candidate for that, assuming that we are putting in valves that don't have very high commissures, that don't have very narrow sinuses. Oh, Kevin, what else do you have to add to that?
Well, they just came out with the 10-year data from the NOTION trial at the most recent PCR meeting. And biological valve failure was similar in the TAVI and the surgical aortic valve groups at 10 years. Now, that's a small study, you know, maybe 150 patients in each arm, but there's no signal there that that's a problem. And that was mirrored also in the PARTNER 3 data that just came out with the 5-year data. So I think we'll see that TAVI valves last as long as biological surgical valves. It's my crystal ball, but that's what I'm anticipating.
Kevin, are you still thinking that the bioprostheses last longer if they're implanted in elderly patients as opposed to younger patients?
Yes, absolutely.
Some hemodynamics. I mean,
you have to remember in the PARTNER 3 trial, the average age was, you know, in the mid-70s, and in the PARTNER 1 and 2, it was in the mid-80s. So that may be deceptive for valve durability.
So this would impact the way you would advise someone who is perhaps 50 and has severe aortic stenosis.
Yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, there's patients that we have flat out told them, you are not a good candidate for TAVI. And they go, okay, thank you. I still want to have a TAVI. You know, so that's a difficult conversation.
What parting advice do you have for our audience on this topic?
Well, I mean, I think that the options have grown. We have more and more options. So, and so I think it's important just to make sure that all options are discussed with the patients and make sure that you're having the full heart team approach and to so that patients are as educated as possible about their decisions. But I think we're just continuing to expand the horizons for these patients and lots of questions that we need to answer, the importance of the commercial alignment, the best anticoagulation, antiplatelet regimen after TAVI is still an ongoing area of investigation as well. And we're also still trying to lower the rates of pacemaker as well, which continues to be a little bit higher with TAVR than with surgery. So there's a lot more for us to learn in this area.
And when I talk to patients, I try to tell them, you want 5 things from your aortic valve replacement. You don't want to die. You don't want to have a stroke. You don't want to have a pacemaker. You don't want to have a major complication like renal failure or bleeding. And you want valve durability. So as long as I touch on those 5 things, you know, they're different with each valve. And as long as the patient understands that and they have to look you in the eye and tell you they understand that, then it's their choice to make. And I think that, you know, even younger patients don't necessarily want to have a sternotomy and they're going to opt for a TAVI procedure, even though, you know, maybe there's a high risk of pacemaker. Maybe the valve durability isn't as good, you know, as long as they understand that, I guess that's okay. At least in the current medical legal environment, it's okay.
Our heart team approach to management of these patients has certainly yielded great results. And this teamwork and looking at continuing to examine our experience and answer these research questions will be really important in the future. Thanks for visiting with me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Feel free to share your thoughts and suggestions about the podcast by emailing cvselfstudy@mayo.edu. Be sure to subscribe to the Mayo Clinic Cardiovascular CME podcast on your favorite platform and tune in each week to explore today's most pressing cardiology topics with your colleagues at Mayo Clinic.
This has been a Mayo Clinic podcast.